am Executive Vice President of the National Education Alliance for Borderline Personality Disorder, or better known as NEA-BPD. I serve with Dr. Perry Hoffman, who has also joined Marie Paul, our presenter, on the line with me. Dr. Hoffman's the president, and Trish Woodward, she's our secretary and treasurer, and we have a wonderful board, plus a scientific advisory board, and we have many dedicated family connections class leaders that you can find across this country. Well, a hearty good evening to all of our callers to this NEA-BPD call-in series that recognizes this year's 10th anniversary of our organization. And I guess I have to beat the NEA-BP drum a bit, because in 10 years, I think there are very few startup nonprofit organizations that have contributed more for their constituents than NEA-BPD. And I want to invite each of you, if you haven't done it yet, come to our website, borderlinepersonalitydisorder.com, to get a flavor of how we're helping families that are struggling with the effects of this challenging brain disorder. So before I introduce tonight's presenter, I want to mention a few details for the evening. First, all callers have been muted to make your listening a much more enjoyable experience. That said, we would appreciate having your questions. So you can email to us now or during the call at neabpd@aol.com. And we're going to do our utmost to answer as many questions as possible. And also, the call-in is being recorded, and in the future, it'll be available on our website. There are handouts with tonight's presentation. If you don't have one, please do, again, write to neabpd@aol.com, and we'll shoot a copy out to you immediately. Now for the good part, just sort of like public television, we do need your donations to achieve our mission. NEA-BPD is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization. Every cent that we get goes into our programs. It's just as easy as going to borderlinepersonalitydisorder.com, click on the donate button. Any amount you give is going to help our cause. It's your cause. So tonight, our presentation comes from a person, I think, with a very deep knowledge of borderline personality disorder, both from family experiences and the many people that she has helped in leading six family connections classes. Our presenter is Marie Paul de Valdivia. She's a board member of NEA-BPD, and for any of you who have taken family connections or teleconnections while she's leading, you'll know that she's really just marvelous and an insightful leader. Marie Paul has an MBA. She's working toward her master's in social work at Yale's New Haven Hospital with studies that focus on dialectical behavior therapy and also substance abuse. Perhaps more important, though, she's a mom with two amazing adult children, one of whom has experienced borderline personality disorder. And this ill daughter is in recovery and enjoys a wonderful relationship now with her family. And there's a lot more I could say about Marie Paul, but I know in the next 30 or 40 minutes you'll get to know her better than I could say. So our questions and answer period will follow with the remaining time. And again, last time, I'm going to remind you that to email your questions to neabpd@aol.com. Now we give you Marie Paul with the subject, Family Connections Must-Have Skills. Marie Paul?
Thank you so much, Jim, and hi, everybody. Good evening. And, you know, I suspect that in their kindness, NEA-BPD has asked me to speak to you all, family members, because they know that it is one of the things I truly love most to do. As Jim said, I have taught several classes, and I really, truly consider myself honored and really so lucky to be able to speak to parents and to relatives of people who suffer so terribly from this illness of borderline personality disorder or from severe emotional dysregulation. As a group leader, and even though I had nothing to do with developing either the therapy, which Marshall Linehan created, or its adaptation for families, which Dr. Hoffman and Dr. Fruzzetti put together for us, I am the one who gets to see, along with other group leaders, of course, firsthand the effect of this amazing set of skills that are part of dialectical behavior therapy and that I am going to tell you about. And then I get to hear amazingly heartwarming stories of wellness and acceptance months and sometimes years later from parents who have taken this journey with me. So now usually I have 12 weeks to speak to you and tell you about these must-have skills and practice them with you. And here we are with an hour, including questions. So we'll have to be efficient and use a few shortcuts. The first shortcut is on the slide that you have, which is titled, What is DBT? So I think it's either the second or the third slide in your deck. And that slide is titled, What is DBT? DBT stands for Dialectical Behavior Therapy. And as its name indicates, it is an approach that is founded on understanding and accepting that apparently contradictory positions can actually both be true at the same time. So one example of dialectic is that life as it currently is unbearable. And at the same time, that this life has to be embraced as it is for change to actually occur. Everything we are going to talk tonight about revolves around dialectics, as you will see. So I'm going to move on for now, but we're going to get back to this concept. Before I start with the rest of the slides, I would like to say to anyone who might be listening in tonight and who actually suffers from BPD or from emotional dysregulation, you are, of course, welcome to stay and listen in. But you might find it difficult. It is never easy to hear people talk about you as they. And tonight, I am going to speak to your families about them, of course, but also about you. If you do choose to stay, please take good care of yourselves. Please be mindful of your emotions. I really would encourage you to leave the call as needed and to come back if you decide that this is what you want to do. So now to you all, family members, the first thing that I am going to say to you is that contrary to what many people no doubt have told you, you are good parents, you are good spouses, you are good children. You care, you are here on this call, you want things to be better in your family, and you want your relative to be safe and function and even be a little happy if possible. You are good parents. Also, you have a person in your life who has special needs, as in different needs. Now, it doesn't look that way because he or she is so smart and often so capable at times, but you do. So the first thing I am going to ask is that you suspend your judgment. And that's the next slide, and it's skill number one. Now, like the rest of the skills we teach, suspending judgment sounds easy, and it's not. But so please bear with me. Let me ask you to imagine that you're driving along, and it's a pretty good road, and there's not much traffic, and so you're going at a good clip. And as you're driving along happily, somebody runs across the street practically right in front of your car and gives you the scare of your life, right? So you have to slam on the brakes. What state are you in? What are you thinking immediately after you can find your breath again, right? And in fact, what kind words might you have for this person as you sort of see them run across the street and reach the other side? So now, as you look at that person getting to the other side of the road, what you see is that there is a dog there, and that this dog is threatening a young child, and that this person is going for the dog. Now what state are you in? What are your thoughts? This is what I'm talking about. To think radically differently, to suspend your judgment. And that is the title of slide four, suspend judgment. Now, from my experience in groups, I know that most of you here tonight struggle with relatives who appear to behave very irrationally at times, impulsively, even sometimes quite dangerously. Those behaviors don't seem to make any sense at all. Or if they do, they appear to actually be intended to infuriate you or to manipulate you. If you could all share what you are going through, I promise you, you would be struck with the general similarity of everyone's experiences and of all the family members' reactions to the experiences. So you would hear about cutting or burning or both. You would hear about substance use or substance abuse, run-ins with the law. You might hear about poor hygiene and pretty amazing sleep patterns that sometimes include staying in bed all day or all week and the impossibility of getting your relative up until early afternoon, right? And now some of you might even be thinking, well, it's worse for us because he hasn't spoken to us in several months. Or she lives with an abusive boyfriend who makes her steal from us. Or she is so depressed and so suicidal, and we just don't know what to do. This is what you need to know. Living with a relative who suffers from borderline personality disorder is really incredibly difficult. Actually, there is research that talks about that and that indicates that families who have a relative with BPD report higher levels of burden, of depression, and of grief than do even family members who have a relative with schizophrenia. And yet, I promise you, the skills we are discussing in this call are also proven to make a very real difference. So you see, there really is a great deal of hope. Now, with this hour limit, here is the first shortcut I was talking about. Remember suspending judgment? Okay, so here it goes. At any point in time, when your child or spouse or parent is acting in a way that doesn't make sense to you and generally scares or infuriates you, they are doing it because they need to, not because they choose to. Now, I'm not saying it's wise or the best choice in the world or even a kind choice. I'm not saying you have to like it, and I'm certainly not saying you have to approve of it. All I am saying is when someone is drinking again or staying out way after a curfew, there is a reason for that. And we're generally not aware of that reason in that moment because it's not expressed in a way that we can understand. So it might help if I tell you just a little bit about the illness. For most of us, emotions can be embraced or expressed, or when they're very painful, they can be tolerated. Now, sometimes, even for us, emotions can be so painful that we organize ourselves to lessen the pain. So, for example, if we are profoundly sad at the passing of a dear friend, we might eventually try to go out or try to think of something else. Or if we're incredibly angry, we might punch a pillow or we might yell out or we might kick a ball or go for a run. Now, try to imagine. What if nothing worked? What if you stayed that sad, or what if you stayed that angry? Chronic dysregulation is exactly that. And that's what borderline personality disorder is about. It means that these incredibly painful emotions happen a lot, and they can last for hours or days. So you see, these are people who are in terrible emotional pain. They have suffered in this way for a long time. And by force, what they have done is they have developed ways of dealing with this. Now, as maladaptive as these ways are, this is how they have survived this painful world so far. So let me go over the spiral. Something happens, as things happen in everybody's life, right? Your relative gets way more upset or way more scared or way more embarrassed than most people do. This feels painful, very painful to them. They can't really talk about it because people don't get it. Or if they do talk about it, after a while they're told to, okay, get over it. And they can't. So they do something to relieve the pain. It might be harmless, like they might disappear in their room for hours, but frequently it's problematic, like getting into a fight or using drugs or meds or alcohol. So then this catches up with them, either because they get caught or because someone yells back at them or because, and that's where you guys come in, someone, even though well-meaning, points out the danger of their behavior, generally in an emotional, angry way. So they feel rejected or embarrassed. Fear and shame come into play. Their emotions escalate further. That leads to yet more emotional pain. That leads to explosive scenes or further destructive behaviors, which are aimed at calming the emotions now. So it's a pretty painful spiral. And how do you stop it? There's our skill number one, suspend judgment. Try to interpret things in the most benign possible way. Try to understand that what you are seeing that is upsetting you so, so much in that moment is a symptom. It's a sign of distress. It's not a deliberate affront. Try to not take it personally. I know it's really hard. You stop the spiral right there. Now, in our classes, we learn to chant to ourselves, benign, benign, benign. So as you are in the middle of a crisis, try to have that in your head, benign, benign, benign. Yes, absolutely, getting upset if your child drinks and drives, and then imposing consequences like grounding and having them pay for the damage to the car, that's good parenting generally. In this case, because the reason for the behavior is different, the way to change things requires a different approach. And that approach starts with thinking that it's benign. Now, that is not to say that you will lend the car again. Skill number two is on the next slide, and that is called healthy selfishness. If the car has been damaged, or even if it hasn't, but there is a chance that it will be, it is perfectly okay to say no. Here's the difference, though. The no is to protect you. It's for you. It's not to attack or retaliate against your relative. Right? This is really important. The no is for you, not against your relative. So lots of I statements there. I wish I could, but I wouldn't be able to relax. I would be too worried. That is how I am. And then, if appropriate, you can even engage in some fact-checking. You know, last time you borrowed it, it came back damaged. I'm not upset about that, but I really don't want it to happen again. Okay? So now, and we're on the next slide, I think it's slide six, here's what we're trying to do. It is a fact that, however difficult, our presence in our relative's life is a definite positive. And there is research on that as well. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to repair what is currently a pre-damaged and volatile relationship. So saying no is not the problem. But saying no for accusatory reasons is the problem, even if those reasons are true. So I'll give you an example of practicing healthy selfishness. I really dislike being late places, even though I often am. But if I invite my daughter, then all bets are off. I might actually never get there at all. So recently, I asked her to join me at one of those home clothing sales events, you know. I knew she'd really, really want to go, and I wanted to go. But before asking her, I checked with myself whether I'd be okay not going. And I was okay not going. So then I asked her. She was very enthusiastic. She really wanted to come. And you know what? She got disorganized. Her time got away from her. She didn't show up. She showed up actually quite late. Like, we would have gotten there, and there would have been 15 minutes left. So it wasn't worth going. So no big deal. I was okay not going. I would have preferred to go, but I was okay not going. Now, sometimes, like the NEA BPD fundraiser in a week, she'd love to come to that. I know it. But I couldn't take the disorganization, and so I'm just not going to ask her. And it's not out of spite. In fact, it sort of makes me sad not to give her this pleasure, and it makes me sad that I don't have the pleasure of her coming with me. But I know that if she didn't come on time, or if she wasn't, you know, dressed the way she wants to be dressed, I'd get upset or she'd get upset. And when I see the pain that my upset causes her, it's not worth it. That's healthy selfishness. Now, I'll bet some of you are thinking that you could take, actually, the damage to the car. You could take not having your child come with you places. But the continual and intense yelling and cursing at you, that is unbearable, right? And that is true. It really is unbearable. Here's a really important personal need, the need to have your relative respect you. No one can take being yelled at for very long without getting burned out. And as I said before, your presence in your ill relative's life is a definite strength for them. So again, when this happens, sort of the same process. Try to remember that this behavior comes from a place of deep pain. This will allow you to keep a gentle, kind, and firm stance. That stance sounds something like, I see how very upset you are, and I'm going to insist that you not insult me. But I do want to hear what you have to say because I'd like to understand. Now, generally, just that one sentence is not enough, especially if the relationship hasn't started to be repaired yet. And the trick is to be a broken record, to not get upset, to continue to stop the spiral right there. And even though it sounds a little bit strange, just repeat yourself. I really see how upset you are. I still do not want you to insult me, but I do want to hear what you have to say. Can you talk to me about it? And it may happen a third time. Please do not insult me. Tell me what is going on. Okay? So a good image to keep in mind there is that of the mask oxygen in the plane. You have to put it, you're asked to, and you have to put it on before you put it on your child, right? Now, to me, I don't know about you guys, but to me, it's always sort of seemed a little selfish in the little movie on the plane, right? Here's this adult putting on the oxygen mask on themselves before the child. But let's say that the child panics, and now you're struggling to put the mask on her, and you don't have it on, right? So you need to have it on first to allow you to then put it on the child. So healthy selfishness is exactly like that. You need the oxygen, right? You can't go down. You have to be there for your relative. So to summarize where we are so far, we are suspending judgment, right? Benign, benign, benign. And we are thinking about our limits, and we're watching for our personal needs. All of this can be encapsulated, summarized, in a very important statement, that in any moment, we are all doing the best that we can. Now, sometimes the best that we can includes getting really upset, and the best they can includes totaling the car. So that's not very good, right? So here is the next dialectic. Remember up front we talked about the dialectics, two somewhat contradicting truths that can both be true at the same time. In that moment, it is the best we can, because if we could, of course, we would all do better. And we all need to try harder. So we're accepting that we're doing the best that we can in that moment, both us and our relative, and we're accepting that we all need to try harder. Now, the next slide is skill number three. It's hard. But the good news is there are two ways to go about it. And generally, people like me who have a hard time with it at first are pretty good at the alternative. Skill number three is called validation. And the alternative is avoiding invalidation. That's on the next slide. So back to skill one, we are not judging. Instead, what we're trying to do is we're trying really, really hard to understand. So when that person crossed the road just in front of your car, of course you would get scared. Here we are talking about trying to understand why instead of getting upset. Right? Now, getting upset is assuming, it's making an assumption. And the assumption is that this person put you both in a great deal of danger for no good reason. And going from there to saying he's a jerk is a really, really small step, right? But if we understand why, then we don't get quite so upset. Here's another example for you. A couple of classes ago, there were some parents in my group who lived in Florida and whose daughter lived in Boston. And they helped her. She lived independently there, but she had several medical visits every week. And one of those visits was with the therapist, and an outpatient therapist. And the deal was that one therapist and that therapy session was with the parents on the phone. All the rest of the treatment was for her independently, but that one was with the parents on the phone. And then one time they came into the group and they told us that they were a little bit worried because the day before their daughter had not shown at the therapist's appointment and they didn't know what was going on. So they were mildly worried. This didn't happen too often. Well, the next week, the daughter again had not been at her therapist's appointment. Now they were more than upset. They were more than worried. They were quite upset. This, you know, there was some thinking that perhaps she was relapsing, that she really was not making the effort that she had promised to make. Third week comes, and she still hasn't shown to her appointment. The assumptions were flying. You know, it was hard to imagine what could have happened, and the fact that she wasn't calling her parents was really not feeling very good to anybody either. They knew that she was okay because the people in the same building that she lived in, they'd been able to get a hold of them, and they had said that she was all right. So they didn't worry about her health, but they worried about her and her mental health, of course, a great deal. Well, here's what they found out. They finally got a hold of her. And what they found out was that a liquor store had opened its doors between her place of residence and the therapist's office. And she, who had been struggling with addiction, was not trusting herself to walk past that store. Now, you know, you could say, could she have taken another way? Of course she could have, but apparently she couldn't, right? She just sort of freaked and she froze, and she just didn't go to the therapist because she did not want to relapse. So here's an example where judgment was easy to make and was very wrong. In fact, what their child was doing was really trying her very best to do the right thing. Right? So there were two truths. It was absolutely true that the parents should have worried, and their thoughts were not wrong thoughts, that their daughter's truth was very different. So here's the dialectic again. Two different truths that can both be true at the same time, even though they seem so contradictory. Okay? So how do you avoid invalidation? Well, to me personally, that was much easier because it involves what not to do, what to just stop doing, and I somehow was better able to do that. So I started to never, ever say, you shouldn't feel this way, or you should behave in this way. I stopped insisting on my solution, even though it sure felt like the right solution. I stopped trying to win the argument. In fact, I learned to replace wanting to win with wanting to understand. It's another little phrase that is in my mind. Instead of becoming frustrated, become curious. Now, I was lucky with just this, trying to, you know, diminishing the level of invalidation, our relations became significantly smoother. And then it became easier for me to learn to validate. So what is this elusive validation? Validation is certainly not just complimenting. What it is it's understanding the other person and communicating that you are understanding. It doesn't mean agreeing. It does not mean liking. It just means understanding and communicating that understanding. Generally, you know, because sometimes you're going to see things that will amaze you. And it's hard to validate those things when you so profoundly disagree with them. So a good thought to keep in mind is to attempt to validate the emotion rather than the action, right? So if you see the fear, or if you see the joy, or if you see the sadness in your relative's communication, and if you can make it make sense to you, and if you can express that, then you have validated. So let's say that your teenager wants to have a party, and your teenager has been struggling with impulsive behavior and with drinking. And your child now is inviting some friends and informs you that he's going to get some alcohol for this party. Right? So immediately, of course, you have this reaction where you're like, what? No, absolutely not. If you stop the judgment, if you're able to recognize that, of course, you have this limit, it makes sense. But at the same time, you need to understand where your child is coming from. You can start to ask questions. And by asking questions, you can understand that perhaps they don't want to be embarrassed and have friends over and not have alcohol at the party. Or perhaps they fear being rejected by their friends or judged. And once you understand that emotion, so let's say it's the embarrassment, and you can communicate that you understand that, the two of you together can work on an alternative, which might be, I don't know, grilling hamburgers together, or choosing and making together another type of drink that's going to be pretty fun but non-alcoholic, right? So now options are open. But first, the understanding of the emotion and the communication of that understanding are key. Now, at its best, validation eventually will stop behaviors from escalating and will eventually bring you to the point where your relative might actually see your point of view. But that's not going to happen at first. And in fact, for all of these skills, the time and place to practice is with others, not with your relative at first, and maybe with your relative, but in quiet times. And absolutely not at first with your relative in a moment of crisis. I mean, you certainly can. And if you do, you should congratulate yourself for trying. It's going to be a little hard because you're not going to see immediate results. All right, so those three skills are terrific. Suspend judgment, take care of yourself, healthy selfishness, validate. And it still seems pretty overwhelming, right? Change is hard, there is no doubt. It's one of the hardest things that there is. For these skills, there are both a context and a stance that will make practicing them a whole lot easier. The context is radical acceptance, and I'm on slide 9. And the stance is mindfulness. So I'm going to explain those two things. And then the first thing I'm going to talk about is radical acceptance. Over all of these skills, what we're really trying to do is make things better. We're trying to fix things. So fixing might mean stopping the fighting or protecting our relative from the consequences of their behaviors, right? But let's face it, there are moments where nothing we do seems to work, even when we have the skills. There are moments where it seems that the problem just cannot be fixed. And those moments are scary. It feels that if we don't do something, the catastrophe we are sure will happen will be even worse. Now if you go to the next slide on radical acceptance, and also if you would think back of all the various problems, big and small, you have faced in your life, I would guess many, many, maybe most of them, you just have fixed, right? Especially the little ones. Now, some of them that you've not been able to fix, you've been able to deal with by changing your emotion about the problem. That's when we say, you know, I never thought I would say that, but I'm pretty glad it worked out that way. Or if someone had told me that I would be happy this problem happened, I never would have believed them. And I'm sort of glad now. And then, you know, there's those problems that just can't get fixed, and you can't change your emotion about. There's no way you're going to ever be happy about it. There are two other possibilities. One is you can just plain stay miserable and suffer. But the last one is you can radically accept it. It sucks. It's awful. I can't believe it. It is my life. My neighbor was in a terrible accident as a teenager, and he remained paralyzed from the waist down. It was awful. He raged for a long time. And then one day, a nurse said to him, you know, you can keep raging against life, or you can put your energy into something else. Now, I'm sure that wasn't the first time somebody said that to him. But that day, he must have been ready to hear it. And that's when he turned it around. By accepting this terrible accident, by making it an integral part of his life, I'm even going to say by embracing it into his life, he was able to let go. His goal was that he would walk down the aisle on the day he would get married. He did. He is married still. He has children. He has a house. He has a boat. And he even can manage to walk without crutches frequently enough. So do you see how his pain, coupled with his original non-acceptance, resulted in yet more suffering until he finally accepted? Now, this is true for the problems with your relatives. And between us, it's also true about your relatives themselves. Like all parents and relatives, you had dreams and expectations, maybe. Let them go. The dialectic is, by letting them go, you might actually enable them. But let them go completely anyways. Leave that space empty for new hopes, new dreams that you don't yet know about. Embrace what is now. It is not what you wanted. It is sad. Look at it. This is when you will see the courage it takes for your loved one to live each day, and the courage you have as well. Rejoice in this. And in every step you take towards non-judgment, towards self-care, and towards understanding. And in terms of stance, do it mindfully. Mindfully means in the moment. Take the time to notice each moment, each effort made. Start practicing this acceptance of what is in very small steps. It's not hard, for example, to accept the beauty of the fall foliage. It's harder to accept a storm that fells the most beautiful tree in your yard. And it's so difficult to accept the devastation of a hurricane. And yet, they all belong to the same series of events, right? This is the dialectic. Notice, accept, let go. And this is when new paths will appear. Please know that we are here doing the best we can to help support you and your loved ones. And that as people who have gone through what you are going through, we also can unequivocally say, follow these steps, practice them, and it will get easier. So remember, suspend judgment, practice healthy selfishness, validate. Try to do so in the context of radical acceptance and in a mindful way. I'm ready for questions.
Yeah, well, we do have some questions, actually lots of them. I think you probably covered this pretty well, but let's just brush up on this one. Acceptance of scary behaviors has a sound of being passive or just giving up. So how can acceptance possibly affect desirable change? You want to give that a shot?
That is such a good question, Jim. That's such a good question. Both you and I have struggled with it, right? Back when we were still sort of struggling with acceptance. Acceptance is really difficult. And it is absolutely true that as parents, we know that when our children behave in a certain way, it's sort of our job to remind them that what they're doing is wrong, is dangerous. And if we don't do that, well, somehow we don't feel that we're being very good parents. As spouses, if our spouse's behavior is dangerous to him or herself, well, then, of course, if we love them, we want to point it out. And it's so difficult to take that breath and to move towards a little bit of acceptance with the goal of repairing this relationship, with the goal of understanding. Because, of course, the moment we go to judgment, which we have to do if we're going to indicate that they shouldn't do this, should is a big judgment word, right? The moment we go to judgment, that's when we stop trying to understand. And if we stop trying to understand, there can be no communication. And if there is no communication, if we're not listening to our relative, why should they listen to us? So that's where the step back is so necessary in order to repair the relationship, establish communication, and move together in a healthier way. Now, that's not to say that it's easy. And that's not to say that at times bad decisions will not be made. Bad decisions will be made. We often say in DBT that our relatives are not responsible for all the problems, for all the suffering, but they're responsible for trying to work on it, for fixing it. All we can do is hold their hand through it. And telling them what not to do just increases their emotion vulnerability and is absolutely not helpful. Accepting that, radically accepting that, is the way towards change. It's because it is the way towards understanding. Does that make sense?
It works for me.
Okay.
Great.
And Jim, you're going to add to anything I say, right?
Since I'm the only one other than Perry that can respond to you, we've got control here. And I hope everybody accepts that, but at least for this evening. Here's kind of a tricky one, but I think it'll answer itself. How does one validate a person with borderline traits without validating the narcissistic traits that may accompany them? That's interesting. Do you have a feeling for that?
A little bit. You sounded like you were going to say something, or no? I'm happy to take it.
Absolutely. Go ahead and do it, because I have a son who has borderline and is narcissistic. So I really want to have this answer from you.
Well, again, so we talked about not invalidating, and we talked about what validation was.
Right.
What we want to be very careful to do is to not validate things that are invalid, right? Now, remembering that somebody who truly suffers from narcissistic traits believes what they're feeling in that moment. Right? It's very important, in order to continue to keep that relationship going, to not validate things that are invalid, but at the same time to stay focused on validating something in order to bring the emotions down and find a common path of understanding. So back when I was talking about what to validate, well, validating the emotion is always a safe bet, because regardless of whether your relative has narcissistic traits or not, the emotion that they're feeling is reality in that moment. The idea is to not judge the emotion, right? So if somebody, your child, your spouse, your parent is getting incredibly angry for something that you don't really understand or something that you feel doesn't justify that level of anger, well, it justifies their level of anger. And validating that means understanding that they are angry and communicating that you understand their anger. So if you stay on the emotion, you're in a safer zone. If you try to validate statements, what? Go ahead.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And I think one of the difficulties that people, whether it's borderline or narcissism, what they suffer from is that no one really understands them. And it's got to feel pretty lonely, sometimes pretty terrifying to be suffering from, quite frankly, in either of those disorders. And I think that validation is such a powerful move toward allowing the person to feel that they're understood. And I can't see where it wouldn't help to strengthen your relationship with them if you take that approach.
Absolutely. And, you know, just to reiterate something really important, remember, it doesn't mean that you have to like it. It doesn't mean you have to agree with it. They may be getting really angry at something that, to you, doesn't seem to justify any anger at all. But that's how they function. And so observing it, noticing it, accepting it, and communicating this acceptance is incredibly soothing to people who suffer from emotional dysregulation.
Okay, here's a quick one, I think, to answer. I'm confused with talk where people bring up the comment. You mentioned limits, but in the same breath, they'll mention boundaries. Are they different?
You know, so much has to do with the way we word things.
Right.
So one of the most common symptoms among borderline patients is fear, irrational, the key word is irrational, but oftentimes irrational also means excessive, fear of abandonment, right? So having boundaries sort of raises the specter of abandonment. It's like there's me on this side and then there's you on this other side. I have to say that other than working on validation, understanding my limits was probably the hardest work that I had to do. It involved really sitting down and thinking it through. And just to give a quick example, there came a time after all my daughter's treatment where, you know, we were lucky. We were able to save for 4 years of college for her. And all the treatment swallowed all that money up really quickly, as I'm sure you're all, you know, familiar with. And there came a moment where, well, we had run out of this money. And so the choice was to go and dig in our son's college fund or to say, that's it, that we stopped, you know, that's it. We now have to figure out something else. Well, in one of my groups, I'd had a parent who was on her third home mortgage to help care for her daughter. And there was a quick sort of thought of guilt in my mind, like this mom was maybe more generous, more kind, more, until quickly the idea of limits came back to me. We each have our own limits. There is no need to feel guilty or embarrassed about our limits. It's important that we know them. It's important that we be able to say, I can go this far. And then beyond that, I can't, because that's taking the oxygen mask off my face. Boundaries is a little bit more of a wall, so I would say it's more of semantics, but limits means this is who I am, and I'm working with you. I'm collaborating with you so that so that I can stay healthy and happy while I'm trying to help you function, as opposed to I'm there, you're here, and, you know, let's have very strict rules. Does that make sense?
Hey, couldn't you hear that resounding yes?
Okay, good.
let's see. I've got so many. Let's see. This is, I think, pretty sticky one. It's a tough one. It hits close to home because it has to do with the question of suicide. But it says, what do I do if a person is, my child, is self-injuring themselves by restricting their eating and are constantly weighing themselves? You know, how do I validate if she weighs even a half a pound more that she is going to state, she's stated that if she weighs a half a pound more, she's going to kill herself. How do you validate frequent talk of suicide? I guess I would start by saying, let's make sure that she's in therapy and with a person who's experienced in dealing with suicidality. But why don't you try the validation part of that?
Yeah, it's so hard and it's so scary. You know, there are things that really push our buttons as family members, especially as parents. And of course, hearing your child speak of suicide is just so incredibly scary. So it pushes your fear button. But validating, again, if we go back to validating the emotion. So to address the validation part of the question, and then we need to talk about the other part, which is the suicidality, of course. But the validation part of the question is, you know, if in the way the question is worded, what I'm hearing is that this particular child, teenager, is incredibly scared of gaining weight for whatever reason that hopefully is being worked on with in therapy. They're validating that fear, honestly. Really understanding where this fear is coming from and saying, I can see how scared you are that you would gain weight. And you know, if it was me and if I was suffering the way you are with anorexia, I guess I really would be afraid of gaining a half a pound, and I really understand that fear. I really get it. Just that is going to be validation. It's really important to realize that this may not be enough. And when anybody speaks of suicide, it is really important to understand that you may need to call for help. That if that person, your loved one, in that moment does not seem to tolerate the distress that they're under, then you need help and you need medical help. So, you know, of course, you know your relative is better than anybody, and you know how they function. But when people think of suicide, you know, you really can't take too many risks there.
Great.
And I'm really sorry for the person who asks that question. I'm sorry for your suffering. That's really difficult. And there is a great deal of hope. I mean, a lot of patients who are in treatment for suicidality, suicidal ideation, which happens frequently in treatment of borderline, do get better. They really do.
Okay. I think, well, while you've touched on this, I think let's bring it up for emphasis. Here's the question. Why do I have to change myself and learn these skills when, after all, I'm not the one who's sick?
And, you know, we've not really talked about the etiology of the disease, which is where does the illness come from? And the illness, most research and evidence seems to show that the illness is a combination of brain, you know, the chemicals in the brain, of genetics, and of environment. So here we have, and it's a terrific question, really, because here we have people who have suffered from probably a pretty young age about this inability to communicate their emotions in a way that was validated by others, and who have developed very maladaptive ways of coping with their emotions. So perhaps, you know, oftentimes, and I'm pretty sure it's true for you too, Jim, when people introduce themselves at the beginning of parent groups, we so often hear, oh, my child was wonderful, so full of promise. A difficult child to raise, though, but so full of promise, or so intelligent, or, you know, so that's a profile we often see. And the difficult to raise part raises a flag. You know, this emotional dysregulation occurred from a long, long time ago. And it is this pattern of invalidation that Dr. Fuzetti explained at length in the last telephone conference that is on the NEABPD website, if you care to go and listen to it. It is this pattern of invalidation that has brought the family to where it is today.
Okay.
Because the relationship in the family is comprised of these sort of patterns, repeated patterns of invalidation, if we can stop the spiral, the whole family is going to benefit from this enormously. And of course we love our relatives, and of course we care, and of course we want them to get better, and we have the possibility of doing this. Now, this is not to say that it's on us. It really is their responsibility to get better also. And if they can be in therapy, especially in dialectical behavior therapy, the progress will be that much greater. There is no question about it. There are some cases that we sometimes hear about where your relative is just not seeing that there's a problem, or they don't think that the problem lies with them. And oftentimes we have seen, as relatives start to get involved and start to try to work on different and changing their behaviors and their patterns, then their loved one will start to communicate with them and will consider getting in therapy. So at some point, the spiral has to stop. It doesn't really rest with any one person, but it's helpful if you do.
Great. Okay, here's one that begs to be answered. Maybe I'll just do it because I think I can do it quickly. How does one find a group that doesn't have a high cost? The one group I have found costs more than I can afford. If the group you're talking about is a gathering of people who are family members and friends of somebody who struggles with borderline personality disorder or the traits of that, good heavens, get to our website and look up the Family Connections program. It's a 3-month program modeled after, at least structurally after the NAMI family to family program, but it is truly developed in order to help those of us who have a family member or friend with this disorder. High cost? No. It's we'll take a donation. It helps us maintain our program. But we would like to have you join us if at all possible. And if you can't get to a meeting that's on the ground, we have teleconnections. We have a long waiting list right now, but we're rapidly trying to increase our number of leaders so that we can offer this more frequently. So thanks for asking that question. Here's a really interesting, tricky one in a way. Validation confuses me. We just got two or three more minutes. But validation confuses me, and an example is when my son, who has BPD, says, I'm ugly and no one wants to look at me. But because he's handsome, I tell him, no, you're one of the best looking in your class. And then he storms off in a rage. What am I doing wrong?
Yeah, and of course you're so full of good intentions by doing that. So it's nice that you're trying to support your friend. So validation is really understanding what somebody is feeling, emotionally feeling at that moment. Most other people we have in our circle of friends might say, "Ah, I look terrible today." And really, well, they look a little worse than usual, or maybe they're actually just wanting to be reassured. No, 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 you look absolutely fine. And it's fine. It's actually sort of what friends do for one another, reassure each other that they're looking good or they're, you know. With our relatives who suffer from emotional dysregulation, when they look at themselves and see somebody that they don't like, somebody that they're uncomfortable with, there is, again, a great, great deal of very painful emotion that comes up. This emotion can be self-hatred. It can be shame. It can be guilt. It can be, you know, all the thoughts of what perhaps they wish they could do or they wish they would have done and they're not able to do. So the emotions are very, very strong. They're very intense. And when somebody comes and says, oh, no, you're great. Well, of course, that is the definition of invalidation. It's not understanding what they're feeling in that moment. What you're doing by saying that is you're really reacting to the appearance rather than to the emotion. You're reacting to facts. It makes perfect sense that you would react to facts. However, with our borderline relatives, it is really important to go to the emotion. And so what would be a good way to validate, you know, oh, I'm so ugly. I can't do anything right. I'm just, you know. Well, a good way to validate that would be, wow, you sound like today is just not a good day. You sound like, you know, you're being hard on yourself right now. And that's, how are you feeling? Tell me about it. And this way, that person feels heard, maybe not completely understood. You're opening the door to communication. But you're not invalidating their feeling, at least. You're allowing them to talk. And it's important to continue to listen. If at that point the answer is something like, well, I have no friends, you know, nobody likes me. Well, it's a whole lot different than just the look. Handsome is not going to help. Right. So, again, trying to address the emotion is going to open the door to communication. And in the end, it's going to open the door to a stronger relationship between you and your friend or between you and your relative. And that's what you're after, because a stronger relationship will allow your relative to listen to some of the advice that you might have in important moments, perhaps down the road. But at the very least, it will calm things down. And that's so important, both for you and for your relative.
I'm going to try to squeak one more question in. I realize we're just right at the hour. But this just came in. How can a person with but I think it's interesting to talk about just briefly. How can a person with BPD be able to hold it together in some situations, such as when they're at school, and then behave so differently when they come home with raging, yelling, threatening behavior? How do you validate this? I guess there's two questions there. But yeah. How can they hold it together?
It's an excellent question. It's an excellent question. So I'm not sure if you remember up front in the when I was talking, when I was saying that they seem so smart, and or they are so smart, and they seem so capable at times. There are moments where everything sort of seems put together. The effort, we call it white knuckling, right, in DBT, the effort it takes to hold yourself together in those moments is absolutely, I mean, really, when you think of the intensity of the emotions that are going on and how hard it is to sit with that, your relative is just shows so much courage in those moments. And then it accumulates. I mean, you know, we certainly cannot imagine that the spiral is not going because they're at school. The spiral is going. The place they can let go is at home. So it's unfortunate, but of course they feel safe at home. That's when they are surrounded by people who perhaps don't understand, but at least where they can sort of let go and let some of those emotions through. And thank God they can let those emotions through, because otherwise, you know, what would the choice be? The pain has to be expressed in some way, shape, or form. So it is all they can do to sort of hold it together outside of home. But then at home, it all falls on you. And that, of course, feels manipulative. It's infuriating. It feels like, you know, why should you be the recipient of all of that? So again, if we can manage to suspend judgment and to really try to understand what is going on and have conversations that are non-judgmental, such as, geez, it seems that when you come home, you are exhausted and you are feeling really tense. What's that about? Can you tell me a little bit about what's going on? Again, non-judgmentally, very important to really be focused on your child and what his or her experience is, but to open that channel of communication in order to perhaps be able to help. And that's when you will hear that this professor did this and this kid did that. Now you're going to hear things that are pretty amazing to you. You're going to hear that this professor looked at me in this way, and oh my gosh, and it's going to be punctuated with pretty colorful language. Important to not invalidate at that moment, to not say, oh, honey, I'm sure he didn't mean it that way. You know, listen, just take it in, validate it. Indeed, if your child felt that a professor looked at her funny, well, that's her impression, that's her emotion. Be with it. Hold her hand through it. If you were in her place, you wouldn't have liked it either. So just say that. And keep the communication going this way. By doing this, you will be able to apply sort of an emotional band-aid. You will be able to help her express her emotions and bring her emotions down. And that's the greatest gift you can give her, because she is in very real pain when she gets home every day.
Super. Marie Paul, thank you so much for sharing your insights, for your wisdom. And I want to thank all of the callers for this evening. I hope you got as much out of it as I did. And I'll mention that our next call is scheduled for October 23rd. That's going to feature Dr. Charlie Swenson, and he'll be talking about the latest developments in DBT. And even though the focus will be for mental health professionals, you know, everybody's invited to this call-in to come and learn. So I just want to say thank you all, and good night.